May it please this Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Missouri, this matter comes before the court on transfer after an appellate opinion unanimously by Judge Howard Spindon, written by Judge Holliger, in which the point one only, which is the only one I think I am supposed to be arguing here today on transfer, was that
everything is before us on transfer as if on original appeal.
All right. Okay. However,
although usually one's arguments are focused on one or two issues,
the clear argument, the undeniably, and I think supported in Judge Holliger, articulated very well, clearly, and this has never happened before in my life after 4 weeks and any other lawyer that I know, and I think we said it was a case of first impression, that when, as Judge Holliger said, we submitted our verdict directors in proper form, substantially supported by the evidence on all the elements of a medical malpractice issue, we had the absolute right, and the judge did not have discretion under Marion versus Marcus and Flock to reject them. The judge did. He had my instructions at the time I made opening statement. He had a clear understanding. And at this point, before I run out of time, I want to make sure, even though in the brief we've cited portions of where each one of the doctors have made the statement, but I would urge the court, as I'm sure the court, we were told in the letter, knows everything. The opening statement I made on page 374 and 447 of my opening statement clearly said in the first line, and Judge Scoville had the instruction and heard it, that it was, we take this man to surgery. They took this man to surgery when he was not hemodynamically stable, which is the first and foremost that Dr. Evans is supposed to make sure of, and everyone else is supposed to be aware and be concerned as well. And secondly, to guard his airway to make sure he doesn't lose his breathing and then lose circulation and going to die. How much more clear from the very beginning does the judge have to have it dealt with?
And Mr. Pickett?
Yes, please.
Did you say that you agreed that the ruling out of the Western District was an issue of first impression, or that they changed the law? Is that what you said when you initially
said in my brief? I saw that we said this is a case of first impression because we could never find where a judge had actually done this to the degree that he did when he had 4 weeks of trial. Marion versus Davis and Plock and other cases were exactly the same principle.
But those were cases out of the Western District. What was the law before those cases?
I believe it was the same.
What has been the law other than those cases, I guess, is my question.
Considering they were the controlling law at the time, but I think the controlling law likewise was, if you have instructions submitted to the court in proper form, they are supported on all the elements in a malpractice case, if that's your underlying cause of action, by substantial evidence, then you have an absolute right in your instructions, if they make sense, and the judge see they are.
You think that was the law prior to Marion?
I'm not familiar with any case from this court that said the cases are clear that you have a right to submit on your theory of the case. But I'm not aware of any case that says you have a right to specific language if your theory is submitted, except those Western District cases. And I'm wondering where that came from and how that fits with the overall body.
Before you answer that, just so I'm clear, isn't the Pluck case Judge Norton's case from the Eastern District?
I believe
those recent Court of Appeals cases. Thank you, Eastern and Western.
Yes, at this point I can't exactly remember, but I know the principle was very clear. And the question was
the distinction between clearly getting to submit your theory of the case versus the specific language.
The theory that Judge Scoville submitted was different than my theory from day that I opened my mouth in opening statement.
That's not something you said to him at the time of the instruction conference. At the time when you put it on the record, you don't say anything about not submitting your theory. You question the particular language you use and whether it has more evidentiary detail or less and so forth.
I said on the entire instruction 3, 3, 5, 2, and therein, Well, other than I think it's a fair and appropriate statement of the ultimate fact issues. The ultimate fact issues were my theory. That was it in a nutshell. Did I say you're taking away my theory, Your Honor? We had an insurance, informal discussion for 5 hours in conference in chambers. And you can see where the judge says again and again, a detailed, extensive,
I made the objection.
The appropriate statement of the ultimate fact issues and does not detail the fact as much as what the court did in its giving. I'm talking about mine is a different.
I understand why you thought yours was correct, but it's not clear to me in what you said or anything else in the record that I've seen so far that you said that what the court chose to submit was not a correct statement of your theory of the case. You didn't like the language as much as that you clearly said that.
I didn't say the theory, but no, the ultimate fact issues, I mean, we've been talking about them forever.
You were talking about yours, but what did you criticize what he was submitting? You were saying yours submitted the ultimate fact issues and you thought had a better statement of the facts than what the court actually submitted. But did you ever tell the court you believed, on the record, that you believed his instructions, which were different than yours, failed to submit your theory of the case?
Did I use the word theory? No.
Or fail to submit the claims which you wanted submitted to the jury?
Yeah, I proffered the instructions that were in black and white, and he read them and clearly. I mean, did I say the word theory? And judge, you're gutting my case. And didn't you pay attention from the very beginning about hemodynamic stability and putting a tube, and they've been clear as a bell? The answer is no, but the ultimate fact issue, that was in black and white. And this was at 6:15 at night. We spent 5 hours in an instruction conference. It had been argued and argued and argued and argued, which the judge says extensively here, 5 or 6 times he knew that. Then on page 3358, again, Your Honor, I'm previously tendered one which I tender again to the court. I object to it specifically in the second disjunctive submission. It states that particular spinal anesthetic was got to be found. Their phrase, if such spinal anesthetic was improper, is totally misleading, is internally argumentative, calls for speculation and conjecture, doesn't make any sense the way it's set forth. Not being critical of you, it doesn't make any sense the way it is. It asked them, failed to object to Dr. Bowser's decision to perform a spinal anesthetic rather than general. That's, I mean, it's confusing, misleading. The language in all of the instructions was almost the same, as you can see, mm-hmm. for Bowser and for Evans and for the first distinctive element.
There's a variance that struck me, at least in Judge Hollinger's decision, that he noted that Dr. Bowser, the instruction as to him, gave an instruction as to duty not to use a spinal anesthetic rather than the plaintiff's proffered instruction that affirmatively said there was a that asked for finding that there was a duty to use an endotracheal tube, because part of the problem here was the regurgitation into the airway of the patient. Isn't that right?
Answer is absolutely correct. As seen in the appendix at 842 and 850, Mine affirmatively said he failed to establish adequate hemodynamic stability by proper restoration of fluid volume, which is the specific explanation of why the jury didn't understand and had the question about what does stable mean. And also the second disjunction, failed to assure an endotracheal tube. That was exactly the same submission as to Dubin as to language.
And that's the evidence showed that if you're going to do a general anesthetic, you had to have the endotracheal tube, and if you're doing a spinal, you didn't, but that could have an effect on blood pressure. And you is that correct?
Something that's not quite correct.
Okay, that's
general
what I want.
General anesthesia can be done by a mask.
Okay.
Where you have nitrous oxide, penicillin, whatever it may be, plus O2. But if you put a tube uh-huh. down and you inflate the cuff, you have general anesthesia mm-hmm. with an assurance, especially when you got a trauma victim, they're expecting mm-hmm. to have their mouth full or their stomach full. Here we had a CT showing he had it full. I mean, there were just so many things. From the very beginning, it was very clear in theory, in proof, my testimony of my experts clearly went all the way down the line. Mm-hmm. And the judge can read, and he was an LPN, and he told us about it. And he completely changed by saying, in Dr. Bowser's example, what was given failed to recognize that William Mitchell was in an unstable hypovolemic condition.
Can you address the prejudice that you believe resulted from this change in language?
Yeah, it gutted my entire theory. I mean, after 4 weeks of trial, thousands of dollars, tons of jury time, on the eve of Christmas, we ended up, I had undue prejudice because I was not allowed to argue my own instructions. You'll notice in my closing argument that I didn't mention the instructions that you always do in my first
30 minutes. But educate me. I'm not understanding the difference that was actually in this, because it seems like different ways of saying very similar things. So explain to me why they're not, because that's what would be really helpful
to me. Okay,
well,
Judge Holliger,
explain why it's
okay.
Why
Judge Holliger said, Evans, permitting William Mitchell, while in an unstable hypovolemic, to be transferred. Permitting a guy to go up there doesn't even have a causal connection. He could have said in the OR room. Mine was, as to Evans, failing to establish adequate hemodynamic stability by proper restoration of fluid volume before allowing surgery. He's the gatekeeper. This is the trauma stuff. This isn't ER taking out a splinter. This is people who are supposed to know. And Evans was not in the OR. It's his duty to do the proper fluid restoration, which was the jury's question. If they'd have had this, they wouldn't have had an understanding. So that when hypovolemia, which is leaking of blood, you have stages of it, and it's trending. And when you put a person, as Dr. Evans said, he was relatively stable. Excuse me, that's like being, you know, halfway pregnant, you know. There is no such thing if you're going to get worse, or starting downhill on a tank of gas and hoping you're going to make it, or, you know. Prejudice, the entire theory, was taken away from me, which doesn't even make any sense. It's so passive, and that's what Judge said. As it relates to Dr. Bowser or Dubin, the same thing. And it was fully supported by Dahlenberg, knowing that he took him to surgery, not just transferred him or looked over there, took him to surgery in an unstable hypovolemic condition. That's what they said, and failed to object to Dr. Bowser. Talk passive. Mine were failed to establish adequate hemodynamic stability. Exactly the same thing as Evan. Bowser had that same duty. You don't take a person to surgery unless they got a tank of gas that's going to get them through what's expecting to lose more blood and everything else, as well as the one on Bowser, which is exactly the same thing, plus he didn't have a tube. So my theories were affirmative, aggressive. The judge flipped them and made them passive, and they made no sense besides because they were confusing, misleading, added words in about finding a proper spinal.
Your opponent argues that lowered your burden, that it made it easier for you to prove your case to the jury.
Well, you can tell that the jury, if that had my instruction, they probably wouldn't give the question about what does stable mean.
Well, your instruction uses the word instability, or your instruction used the word stability, and theirs used unstable. So
mine defined it. Failed to establish adequate. We're supposed to be neutral. Adequate hemodynamic stability by proper restoration of fluid volume before allowing surgery. That's what the big difference is. He, meaning Evans, didn't have him prepared. Then you have the same check that's got to be done when he's in the pre-actual surgery by the anesthesia. And they were supporting his blood pressure artificially. He was hypovolemic. He was hemodynamically unstable. Everybody said he was hypovolemic. You lose blood in varying degrees.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired.
Okay.
May it please the court. Thank you. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm going to first jump right into the jury instruction issue. There are three issues related to jury instructions. First, whether appellant made a proper Rule 70.03 objection at trial. Second, whether substantial evidence supported appellant's proposed jury instructions. And third, the prejudice issue. I'm going to dive right into the first issue.
Did you object to these instructions?
Pardon me, Your Honor?
Did you object to these instructions?
We did object to the instructions. I felt the instructions all across the board allowed for a roving. I thought they were too broad. They allowed too many opportunities for the jury to find for the plaintiff.
Mr. Pratt, Would you agree then, those three arguments seem to go to alternative basis to affirm the trial court's judgment without reaching the ultimate issue of whether or not 70.02 requires the trial court to submit an instruction from the person who has the burden of proof, whether it's the plaintiff or defendant. And those are three ways that your case could be affirmed without really dealing with that issue. So before you go to those, would you tell me whether or not you agree that the Court of Appeals opinion and the other Court of Appeals opinions are correct on the law as it relates to the tendered instructions?
I believe they are correct on the Marion case in the Western District and the Plott case in the Eastern District. And I don't think when those decisions were decided represent a seismic shift in Missouri law.
Right. I appreciate your candor in that regard.
And I can tell you. So the issue then that the court should decide, I think, is whether substantial evidence supported appellant's proposed instructions. And I'm here to tell you, and I'll jump right to that point. I'll go back up to the objection issue in a moment. I think the issue is this. There are three different defendants at trial. A surgeon, a trauma surgeon, Dr. Evans, an orthopedic, Dr. Dubin, and an anesthesiologist, Dr. Bowser. At trial, and this is an appellant's own brief, there were three different experts, one for each of the respective doctors. So what you should do, and what the trial judge did, is he looked, what did Dr. Tile, appellant's expert, say to provide support for the instruction given to Dr. Evans? Where in the transcript did Dr. Dauenberg provide the evidence and support for Dubin's instruction? Dr. Hamm was the appellant's expert for Dr. Bowser. So it's a pretty simple concept. Show me where in the transcript, where in the case, where is the evidence supporting the instruction? What did those respective experts, appellant's own experts, say about the defendants in the case? And that's what we should be asking. Show me the citation to the record that demonstrates the support for your proposed instruction. I've never seen it.
Well, Mr. Pickett says they all testified that it was a failure to stabilize the patient through sufficient fluids, giving this final anesthetic caused a greater loss in pressure, and then at that point they should have realized they could not operate without putting in the tube to protect the lung.
And I think if you look at this case very broadly and kind of pull bits and pieces from what some of the experts say, I think you can probably get there, Judge. But I think what you have to do is you've got to have some support. You know, Dr. Dauenberg didn't offer any opinions to Evans. So to say that his opinion supported the instruction against Evans, I think, is inappropriate. I think you must look at what appellant's own expert, who he identified the only person against Dr. Evans, against Dr. Bowser, and against Dr. Dubin. You have to look at their testimony. And I think if you kind of look at it broadly in globo and to try to offer some speculation and conjecture to it, I think you can get there. But still, I don't think you have to cite some specific reference to where is the evidentiary basis for your proposed jury instruction. And at least to this point, I still don't see it in any of the briefs unless you get sort of broad, big picture. And if you do that, you might as well throw out the Marion case, because it says you can say whatever you want as long as you can kind of sort of get there. What the Marion case stands for is that you're entitled to your instruction, but the natural inherent limitation of that is the evidence. So you're entitled to instruction, but show me what evidence supports the instruction. And at least at this point, I simply cannot find a single citation in the record supporting any of the instructions.
So what is the difference between the instructions as he asked for it and then as given? Or are you saying the evidence didn't support the instructions as given either? Or how?
Well, sort of. That goes to more the prejudice issue. Uh-huh. Because the Marion case says you've got to have support for it, and it goes to the prejudice issue. If you look to that issue to say, okay, what supported the actual instructions given? I just turned to page 67 of appellant's own brief. Let's see what Dr. Tile said. If you look at page 67 of appellant's own brief, in Dr. Tile's opinion, Dr. Evans allowed William Mitchell to go to surgery while he was in a hypovolemic state. Okay, let's look at the instruction that was given to the jury. Permitted William Mitchell, while in an unstable hypovolemic condition, to be transferred to surgery. Same thing. So how can you state that there's prejudice when your own expert, your expert's opinion, and your own brief is exactly what went to the jury? And I think that goes under the Marion and the Plott cases, that goes to the prejudice issue. How can you say there is any prejudice whatsoever when what you say your own expert said against the defendant was what was actually submitted to the jury? It's hard to complain that there's prejudice, at least at this point. Let me jump right back up. I'm going to go back up to the beginning and talk about the objections issue. As we know, Rule 70.03 requires a specific objection with some ground with the grounds for the basis for the objection. If you look at the record on appeal, never states all the stuff that we're talking about today, all the stuff that's contained within the briefs, it's never, not a single piece is articulated to the trial judge. So that causes us to try to play Monday morning quarterback without ever seeing what happened on the field. So for us, we're in the untenable, difficult position. I can read the objection. The objection to Dr. Evans is, well, other than I think it is a fair and appropriate statement of the ultimate fact issues, and does not detail the facts as much as what the court did in his given. I don't know what that means, but I do know that's not a Rule 70.03 objection. So we're blind because we don't know exactly what happened to the trial court. It's hard for us then to make it an opinion. Now, the appeals court got around this issue by citing and recognizing there were some off-the-record conversations. Now, I think there is. There's off-the-record conversations in every single trial in this entire state, civil and criminal. But that's never been used as a support of basis. It's never been used to support a basis for a Rule 70.03 objection. And if you allow that, you might as well get rid of 70.03 and to say, listen, we'll just try to take everything up. We'll let everybody try to fight it on the briefs. And he said, that's not the best administration of justice in my
opinion. There's an obligation to put a summary of whatever's happened off the record on the record at the beginning of the instruction conference.
Exactly. And that's what we've all done as we tried every case. We go and we fight for things off the record, but we know when I'm on the record, I'm not speaking just to the trial judge. I'm making sure that we can make a clear record on appeal that the trial judge knows exactly what I'm talking about.
If I can follow up a little bit on the question Judge Fisher asked, are you saying it is error always for the trial judge to refuse an instruction if it's supported by the evidence, but you look at whether or not it was prejudicial, or are there situations where it's appropriate to correct an error, correct confusing language, and so forth?
Yeah, I'm not here before you to tell you the Mary and the Plot cases were a poor application of Missouri law. What I am saying is what those cases require is to say if a plaintiff's lawyer submits an instruction that's in proper form and submitted by the evidence, they're entitled to offer that.
Your brief says that you're citing the Missouri approved jury instruction, that it reflects the non-delegable duty in its reference to identifying instructions prepared at the court's discretion, and refers to it's the judicial duty to give the complete charge, and the court may give instructions without the request of counsel. So at least the Missouri approved instructions indicate the judge has discretion.
I think the judge has the discretion to say, I think it's the judge's non-delegable duty to determine and to ensure that the instructions offered by the plaintiff comport with the evidence.
Right.
And that's what I mean by that. I mean, that's right. What's so critical is, listen, it's the judge. You can't just say the judge is completely out of the picture. You can do whatever you want,
well,
say whatever you want.
Let me ask you this. What do you make of the provision then in Rule 70.02 that says that each copy shall indicate whether it was prepared at the court's direction or the party or by the party which it was tendered, and shall contain a notation as follows. So does that seem to indicate that the rule contemplates that you either have an instruction offered by a party and accepted by the court or rejected by the court, or prepared at the court's direction by the party offering it? In other words, what happened here was the court on his own wrote his own set of instructions.
Correct.
Let me add one more third option that you might want. Because doesn't the May provision in that rule really deal with situations where the trial judge thinks there needs to be some additional instruction not offered by either party?
I think so. And I think, or, you know, you talk about the early instructions, but I still think it's the judge's non-delegable duty to make sure and to be a gatekeeper to ensure that the instructions offered by a party comport with the evidence. And that's all. And I'm not here to tell you that.
And you're saying here the court did not find that to be the case?
It's clear, yeah. The court found that the instructions offered by the appellant were not supported by substantial evidence. And we agree. And I could say, and so then you look and say, under Marion versus Pluck, I think that's the issue. And then you go and then you say, I think that's the issue. And that is dispositive. Once that issue is resolved, then I think you can affirm the trial court. So unless you find something specific in the record and to say that these instructions were supported by substantial evidence under both Marion and the Pluck, this court can then affirm the trial court. If you find somehow, and you can find somehow that the evidence was supported by the evidence of trial, your next issue under Marion and Pluck is to look at prejudice. And I'm here to tell you there's no prejudice in this case. The Court of Appeals opinion got around the prejudice issue by saying that they were different. Well, of course, and with all due respect to the Court of Appeals, of course they were different, or else we're not here. So in every single case, they're going to be different. There has to be something more than that, and that's what this court said in the State versus Block case. It says that it must materially affect the merits of the action. And how can the instructions actually submitted to the jury in this case have been materially affected the action when it's the exact same statement appellant's expert said contained in appellant's own brief? You only have to look so far as appellant's own brief to see it. And also, it's not disputed that the instructions actually submitted to the jury made it easier for the jury to find for the appellant, which is why we objected.
Can you make it that same argument as to the other two doctors?
I can. Absolutely. It did. Because it took away some of the obligations. It said basically you could find for the plaintiff broadly, not for the specific reasons cited by appellant's proposed instructions. And that's for all the doctors in the case.
So, and your argument is you argued that was a bad instruction because it gave too many options.
Correct. Yeah, our objection was it gave too much of a roving commission to the jury. I still believe it was too broad of an instruction. The jury ultimately found us not liable in the case.
Can you address Mr. Pickett's concern that the jury was confused about what stability was and that the failure to give his instruction is what caused that?
Well, sure. I think that goes to the issue of it is all of our responsibilities to make sure our experts provide some background and basis to the jury. So if you think about it in this case, it's my job and responsibility to make sure that the experts provide the evidence. So whether you call something instability or unstable, whether you interchange that, listen, it's my responsibility to make sure that the language used by our experts that they understand. So, and I think you've got to give the jury some faith that they know the difference between unstable and instability. And you know, I don't think you can look to a jury question and look to a question on a piece of paper to say, you know, this entire jury, try to glean a whole lot from the jury questions. This court doesn't take a lot from a lot of the jury questions and throughout our Missouri law. But I think it goes down also to, I think the first issue is dispositive on the failure to object. The failure to object, because there's no objection, I believe this court should look at it under the plain error standard review. And under the plain error standard review, I think it's pretty clear that there's no manifest injustice or some miscarriage of justice. And I think at the very beginning, I think that's the easiest way for the court and the likely way for this court to dispose of this case. Because there is no proper objection trial, because everything that we're talking about today, everything contained in the brief, was never brought before the trial court. And it's not in the record, as we say. So I think the plain error standard review is appropriate. And I think because there is no manifest injustice, and all you have to do is to look at the instructions actually given, and you can assure yourself that there's no manifest injustice or a miscarriage of justice based upon the instructions that are given. And I think the next issue, even if the court finds that there was a proper objection, then I think you move to the next level under both Marion and Pluck. Was there substantial evidence to support the instruction? And there's nowhere. Show me a line or page in the transcript that show where Dr. Tiles' testimony supported the evidence instruction. Dallenberg supported the Dubin instruction. Ham supported the Bowser instruction.
So what you're really arguing to us is that the Court of Appeals made an error and that we ought to correct its error.
I'm saying that the Court of Appeals should have determined that there is no proper objection, applied the plain error standard review, and then said there is no manifest injustice or miscarriage of justice, and then affirmed the trial court.
In other words, the Court of Appeals was right on the law, they were wrong on the record.
I think they were right in their application of Marion and Pluck. And I'm not here to tell you that Marion and Pluck should be overruled or overturned. I'm saying in this particular case, there is no objection, and it should, under the plain error standard review, it should be
from the trial. Are you really saying that plaintiff just didn't make his case with his expert witnesses?
I'm saying that the plaintiff's expert witnesses, that their testimony did not support the instruction.
But
that would be insufficiency of the evidence,
correct,
wouldn't it?
That
he should have been directed out then.
I believe it should have been directed out against all three.
What you're saying is that the specific instruction that they wanted to submit, and that's why the court made it a more general one? Or are you saying?
I don't think I heard you correctly, Judge.
Are you objecting that the instructions actually given were not supported by the evidence? That's not something that's been raised on appeal. Or are you trying to explain why the court changed the instructions?
I'm trying to say that the instructions under Marion and Pluck plaintiff is entitled to their instruction if it's supported by the evidence. And I mean, under those cases, that there is not substantial evidence to support the instruction submitted
that,
by
that the plaintiff offered.
Correct.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
As follows, I will direct you to transcript 3-1181 through 1319 fully, although quoted part in the brief, specifically Dr. Dubin's testimony on both elements, or Dr. Dahlenberg's on Dr. Dubin's, specifically on all elements, clear as a bell, again and again, clearly substantial evidence. Dr. Ham's testimony, likewise, same transcript, 3, pages 1319 to 1572, partially in our brief as well, clear as a bell about tubing and hemodynamic stability. Dr. Tile, transcript 2, 1134 plus 1150 plus the supplemental deposition
counsel,
of the video that was
counsel,
transcribed.
Counsel, is it in the record with your questioning for the expert witnesses? Does each expert say that each doctor that's a defendant here failed to meet the proper standard of care in the following respects?
No, because the defense made that statement. I was limited to one expert per Dahlenberg.
I know, but for every defendant doctor in this case, do you have an expert saying he failed to meet the proper medical standard of care?
One ortho, one trauma person who happens to be, of course, you don't have to be a trauma person, but a Tile was. Yes.
Right. Okay, so you have the standard opinion statement that you have to have in medical malpractice.
Plus causation, forensic pathologist, et cetera,
now,
et cetera.
Now, shouldn't your verdict director follow that testimony?
That's what my opening statement said. That's what my verdict director said. They were rejected. My theory was thrown out.
Well,
that's why I was.
It does sound like Dr. Evans said exactly what was in the defendant's, that court's verdict director, doesn't it?
They quote the statement
he made?
The answer is no.
Okay.
The answer is no. Transferring somebody isn't avoiding him going to surgery. No. And as far as the stability.
Let me ask the same. Judge Steth
and
I are getting to the same point here. Is if we go through the record and the language of the instruction matches up pretty close to the language of the testimony of your expert witnesses, wouldn't that be a proper instruction for the court to give?
My instructions.
No. The instruction the court gives, if it matches up with the language of your experts, how could that? Let me ask it this way: how could it be improper?
It won't
match up. I understand that.
And even though he mentions stability, like Dr. Copeland was a neurosurgeon. Stable, he says, you can take the guy to surgery, but he's got a potential fracture. Enough, he didn't.
Let me just, to make this
and
simpler.
And the word stable, you know.
Yeah, to make this simpler for me, so I get it, is that really, when we're looking at this case, all I need to do is open up the transcript, read your expert's testimony, then read the instruction, and that will tell me whether or not if that instruction matches, it's okay. If it doesn't match, then we look at whether it's prejudicial. Is that the way I go about deciding this case?
And you can, Judge Holliger clearly says there are different theories of negligence, and that's what's important. Transferring and making sure somebody's ready, two separate things totally. That's the issue.
And then for that, we have to reach the issue of whether or not you made that objection and preserved that issue, or whether it's
On Bauer, Bowser, and Richardson, and Dubin, I made all kinds of objections, confusing, misleading, etc. The only one about statement of the issue relates to Evans, which was exactly the fact that, excuse me, Your Honor, this is clear as a bell.
And there's one more question from Judge Tidal, and then your time is up.
Where did you preserve the error?
Pardon?
Where in your record did you preserve the error?
I preserved the error in three different places, which is what I quoted earlier. The first one asked Evans on page 3355 of the transcript, where I says that mine is an appropriate and fair statement of the ultimate fact issue. Now, isn't ultimate fact issue the theory of the case?
But you keep talking about
that's
your
Evans.
The question is, where did you preserve your objection to the instruction the court actually gave, not to the not giving your instruction, but where did you preserve your objection to the one the court actually gave?
That's it, right there. I object to it.
You're talking about yours, but you never say his is incorrect, do you? I mean, maybe you do. I'm not clear how that says that
and it does not detail the facts as much what the court did and is giving.
Okay.
I mean, I said the court is giving, and then on the second one as to Bowser and those things, there it took forever. You know, it's misleading. It's internally argumentative. It calls for speculation and conjecture. It doesn't make any sense. I mean, how much more specific you can be.
Appreciate your argument.
And then if you speak to, if I may, speak to other issues that just belabored this case evidentiary, which was a circus, if you speak to other issues.
Thank you.
Appreciate the court's time.
Appreciate both your arguments, and thank you very much. The case is submitted.